We are on 31 and 2, maybe? Okay. Like maybe even 32, 33, something like that.
I have 33 marks, but if you want to go back to 31, go back to 31.
I think, okay, all right. So the Second Continental Congress has met. They will meet continually from this point on, as I said before, from 1775 all the way to 1790, I guess, or 1789. Clearly through the war years, they are the governing body, or the governing body of the, I would say colonies, but when they declare independence, they become states. And they have chosen Washington to command a United Continental Army, which was a mixture of some trained regulars and a lot of militia and a lot of just people who showed up when they felt like it, which was difficult to keep discipline over. But Washington learned very early that harsh discipline and traditional military procedures did not reach the majority of his troops, but instead heart-to-heart talks and reminding of the mission and a sense of future dreams for the country, that's what really kept people loyal and cooperative. And that was a great credit to Washington that he was that kind of person. He understood military discipline, he also understood how to communicate the dream and the mission. And there's a few critical people in the Revolution. He's clearly one in that sense. We'll talk more about him a little later about how people felt about him. But one of the things I think that is interesting to look at, we know how the story turns out. We know that the good guys, us, win. And although there were some troubles along the way, that we always approach this, it seems like, with a predestined, almost Calvinist view that we were ultimately determined to win. But there were many, many opportunities at the situation where it could have turned bad. I was thinking about it, I was driving over. I was going, I said, what should I say? And I think, well, I think that once you reach the point where blood was drawn at Lexington and Concord, and especially later with Boston and New York, that, as I was about to say, there was no way the Americans would have settled for anything short of some kind of negotiated union, even if it wasn't full independence, something like a home rule arrangement like the Dominion of New England or maybe like the Albany Plan. But there I was already assuming as I was driving that that would be based on victory and that it could have gone more like the Tiananmen Square circumstance. And that is, leaders are crushed, people are killed instantly, and that squelched it, and we didn't see it for a long time afterwards. So it could have gone either way, and that's how they had to live with it. That there was no certain future. And so when people staked lives, property, sacred honor, et cetera, on such a thing, they really knew that this could go either direction. And logically, when a group of revolutionaries stand up to the greatest military force on the planet with nothing other than just the crudest of weapons, it doesn't look like you could win that situation. And yet, so there had to be some kind of a real courage in the American revolutionaries that started this. And on top of that, the Continental Congress, Second Continental Congress, didn't outline a goal. They didn't say, this is a struggle now that will go all the way to independence. They left it. They didn't say, we're going to fight for a year or two and have a negotiated settlement. There was no goal put forward. It was just resistance. And I think that's probably because among the delegates that came to the Second Continental Congress, there was not any kind of consensus. There wasn't a clarity of purpose. Some radicals like Hancock and Samuel Adams and Patrick Henry had clamored from the very start for immediate seeking of independence. There were others like Joseph Galloway, who remained loyalist and wouldn't even see in the fight, who had advocated some kind of peaceful, negotiated home rule arrangement. But the fight goes on. And in May, I'm 33, let me get these dates kind of correct here. That should say May 1775, not 6, below the Bunker Hill. In fact, I should have put it first. In May of 1775, Forts Ticonderoga and Crown Point that are in northern New York and western Vermont, northwestern Vermont, were attacked by Benedict Arnold, the one who would later become a traitor, as well as a group of Vermont militia known as the Green Mountain Boys, led by Ethan Allen. The British just didn't expect this at all, that these people would march from, well, essentially most of the people were marching from Boston all the way up to northern New York near Canada to attack these forts for the sake of, I think they dragged something like 100 and something, actually 70 something cannons back to Boston. And it was the strength of those cannons as well as the Continental Army that would lead to the victory in Boston. Of those battles, the first one of a major historic memory is the Bunker Hill battle that was actually fought on neighboring Breed's Hill. But again, let me repeat this, that it was the strength of the colonial forces was so impressive that the British did evacuate Boston, never to come back. So the starting fight is a success for American forces. Even though, again, no one spoke of what's the goal, what's the purpose of resistance. Britain's response is in 34. The Parliament issues an order closing all colonial ports. And German mercenary soldiers from the province of Hesse, where Frankfurt is, are hired to assist the British in the fight. Now, there's a couple of reasons for this. The Hessians were known for their ferocity, and it was hoped that just the hearing of Hessians coming would so intimidate and frighten colonists that they would stop the resistance. But also the British did not want to tie down their best crack troops in this suppression of a rebellion because they anticipated that this thing is going to spread to a European war. Like a fifth war since 1689 has been erupted. So the Hessians are hired for that purpose, and their presence, instead of intimidating Americans, unites Americans. The insult of mercenaries brought in to do the work that regular soldiers won't do. As 1775 turns into 1776, and this struggle still doesn't have a goal, it will finally gain one as the result of the help of an Englishman named Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine's an interesting character. He, when asked, said he was a citizen of the world, of no specific country but all countries. He was a citizen of freedom. In a conversation between Thomas Paine and John Adams, John Adams was trying to make a comment. The comment was something like, if there is no freedom, that is not my country. And Paine turned it around and says, where there is no freedom yet, that will become my country. Suggesting that you have a mission to save people that are in tyranny. And as an Englishman, he really did have this feeling that there was a worldwide democratic revolution spreading, and it was his purpose in life to be at the forefront of each battle. I'm not a pro-communist, I don't see that at all, but I see sometimes the fanatic rhetoric that comes out of former communist revolutionaries and kind of the Che Guevara attitude of wherever in Latin America the next battle is and where he will be. This was Thomas Paine's feeling, except it was for democracy rather than communism. And he had made friends with Franklin back in the early 70s when Franklin was a lobbyist at Parliament trying to prevent certain navigation laws from being passed. And Franklin was impressed by Paine. They spoke at great lengths about political philosophy. Franklin said, if you ever want a place to stay and a job in America, you're always welcome at my printing press in Philadelphia. So in late 75 and early 76, that's exactly what he did. Paine came to America with a mission in mind to unite the Americans to go the full nine yards for independence. He did so through the publications of the pamphlet, Common Sense. In Common Sense, he used Enlightenment principles to explain why it was obvious that ultimately the United States was going to be a continental power, would spread from coast to coast, and it would never make sense for a full continental power to be tied to a small island. That the reverse would be the case, Paine even predicted, that the day would come that all of Europe, and especially the island of England, would revolve around the interests of the United States as a world power. So he was very hyped up in propaganda, or had a good foresight of both, since he saw the future for the United States. Making astronomical parallels, since it was popular to talk about what smaller satellites rotating around larger bodies, such as Earth and Sun, the same parallel is being made that the United States would become like the Sun in a sense, and others would rotate around it. So then, from this perspective, if it is obvious and inevitable, and I always like this kind of inevitability that people like to think, the ones that believe in ultimate free will at the same time feel they have no choice, they must do it with their mission, that Americans needed to realize that the day would come when the United States would be a separate nation. It can come now or it can come later. Those involved in the revolution now have the pride and the opportunity to be the ones that do it rather than the irresponsible shirkers who leave it to their children to do it. So those are moving words. And Common Sense did move middle ground public opinion towards the revolution. So much so that by the summer of 1776, the representatives at the Second Continental Congress felt it was the time to write and issue a Declaration of Independence. And even that was done a bit prematurely. I mean, it didn't reflect majority public opinion. At best, it reflected probably one-third of American public opinion. Even by the best times of the war, only about a third of the public was truly committed to the cause. Another third of the public was probably loyalist, Tory, pro-England. And then the other third is probably which flag's coming down the road that day is where they stood. Happens a lot. So a declaration is drawn up and is officially accepted and adopted on July 4th. It's not actually signed until August 2nd. The committee of names here in 36 are the ones assigned to do the work. Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Roger Sherman, Robert Livingston, and Jefferson. But as is the case in all committee work, one person does all the work and everybody else gets the credit. You've worked in those kind of arrangements. And everybody knew quickly that Jefferson was hot to put his own ideas into this document. And so everybody deferred and said, oh Tom, you're better at this and you can say these things better and you've been thinking these things out. So it ended up being almost a complete Jefferson track, and the rest of them offered occasional grammar changes. One of the changes that Ben Franklin offered to Jefferson was that in the original document, the phrase life, liberty, and the rights of property were given, which is almost a direct quote from John Locke's two treatises on government. And Franklin warned Jefferson that you have property, a large plantation, I have property, a number of investment businesses and publishing companies, but a lot of these frontier folk that we're trying to get help us join the revolution do not have property. And they may misinterpret what you mean by that. They may think that they have a right to our property. Now let's make this clear what this revolution's about. It's not about wealth being distributed to those who don't have it. So let's change that phrase. So the phrase rights of property was changed to pursuit of happiness. But still the idea that rights of property, the Enlightenment theory of rights of property, was the foundation of the revolution is found when we come to looking at the Bill of Rights, which came shortly thereafter. There is a concept again about right of property in the Fifth Amendment. And that's also something about this revolution that I want to take some time to comment on. John Adams was the more conservative, socially conservative of this bunch of people. And when asked after the war how he felt about the American Revolution, he made comments that a lot of people had gotten confused. Things had turned out badly. Some people just never understood what this revolution's about. Some people go so far as to think that Indians, women, and African Americans expect to be free and equal. So, I mean, that's so politically incorrect for today, but in 1783, it was the John Adams view, and it was more than the John Adams view. If that wasn't supposed to happen, then what was the revolution all about? Yes, exactly. It's that maintenance of what they had before the French and Indian War. Getting back to living the way we were, unmolested by British taxes. And it surely, in his mind, was not supposed to be a social revolution that changed people's places in society. It was a we don't want to pay taxes revolution. That was the idea of it. Well, Jefferson's attitude about this is, if it's kind of a giddy, exciting, I get to do all the work, as well as if they're going to saddle me with all the work, then I'm going to throw all my particular agenda into this document. And so much of the wording has a strong Enlightenment flavor to it, bordering on flirtatiously deist. And let's talk a little bit about that. But what is deism? Those are familiar with it. Or what was it, maybe? I don't know if anybody's still a card-carrying deist left anymore. But 18th century, they were. Well, it was kind of a, and I don't want to be unfair to deists, half-religion, half-philosophy way of living. It centered around the idea that there was a deity that did create a universe, in fact, create a universe that worked on very mechanistic, scientific, natural law principles. So it is this inclusion of the Enlightenment ideas with religion. and that once this universe was established and wound up and ready to roll, then the master clockmaker sets the clock, steps out of the way, and lets it run its course and does not intervene anymore to change things. So if you have a mechanistic universe that runs according to natural laws, that the deity does not step into it, intercede any further, and it's, in that sense, I find it not a lot different than Calvinism, and that there is a predestined arrangement. I mean, I think that's probably popular itself. What's a person's religious obligations in such a faith? None. One doesn't have to pray, one doesn't have to go to church. It's not going to make a difference anyway. In fact, the deist thinking is you should spend more of your time contemplating the scientific, rational aspects than the mystic aspects. So that's very convenient for people who thought in those realms already but still did not want to have to face whether or not they did or didn't believe in the deity. And all these people that were deists, Franklin was one, Jefferson was one, Washington was one, were also church members of a given church. So this is kind of their bent and twist they put on faith. Jefferson was the most radical of them. And so he kind of wanted to put together an Enlightenment deist view of why this revolution is being launched. And in that respect, I think it's misleading. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, and you see some radical ideas in there, I don't think the majority of Americans were fighting for what's in that declaration. They were fighting for freedom, but not the spin he put on it. I'm going to read from it here in a minute to demonstrate that. Another thing about the declaration is Jefferson put quite a few paragraph section in there about the evils of the slave trade and how it was England that had got America hooked on slavery and the slave trade, and how one way to truly recant the evil of slavery and the evil of England getting us addicted to slavery would be to stop the slave trade and abolish slavery as a way of showing that we're free from English evil influence. When that was shown to the committee, the jaws dropped. I said, do you think any of the southern colonies are going to say in this fight with that in this document? They just almost said to him, literally, find some other way to get rid of your guilt, because this is not the way it's going to work. We're not going to have this impact. So that was dropped from the declaration. But let me read from it a little bit and see if you catch the flavor that I'm claiming here. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. First, we have to praise this excellent run-on sentence. Love run-on sentences. This is one of the best. What's he saying? Yes, that when one separates, one should tell why. And we're going to and hear the reasons. That's true. But he puts in things like, to assume the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station among the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. What is all this? Laws of nature, that's enlightenment. Nature's God? Not even God's nature. That's, I think, pretty radical. Suggesting that a deity itself would be subject to physical natural laws. That's not something that's widely believed today. So that was quite radical. Next paragraph goes on and says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Here's going farther. Did he mean all humans? Are all white males that own property? That's always been a great debate. Slave owner, also ardent sexist. Letters between Adams and Jefferson both talked about how foolish they thought it was that women tried to put into the documents gender equality comments. That was John Adams' wife saying that. But since he lived in the 1770s, can we give him a pass? I like that hesitation. Okay, anyway, all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That's an interesting comment. Governments are derived or instituted among men. Where else would they be instituted from? From God, maybe? So this is a strike at the divine right concept, that the governments are based on human frailty, human judgment, not divinity. Deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That is so enlightenment. That a government exists only because of the consent of the governed, implying therefore the opposite, that if they lose the consent, they lose authority. Which is in the next sentence. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute new government. So let's ask this question. When a group of survivalists go up in the woods and refuse to pay taxes and start getting heavy with weapons activity, and then start making comments about how, in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, we're going to abolish our government because they've lost our consent. What's your response to that? Is that, well, I guess that's legal. I hope I'm not speaking of anybody. He's giving me the serious look out there. I guess it's true. The numbers make the difference. I was hoping you would say something like this. Let's go back to the sentence and say, alter or abolish, and therefore the right to alter exists. There are peaceful ways to alter government, like to elections. Yeah. So if that's true, if there are peaceful ways to express your discontent or loss of consent for the governed, why didn't the Americans just use the peaceful election method? That's it, exactly. But after repeated requests and comments and observations of either let us have a voice, which they really didn't want, or saying, since we don't have a voice, leave us alone. This was, the constitutional basis here was that if it's a local tax, a local law that our legislatures can make, we're willing to consent to that because we elect people to that. If it is an international imperial measure that nobody really has a choice on, we're willing to consent to that. But when Parliament makes a law that only applies to us locally, there is the constitutional problem that violates our rights, and that's where we lose consent. And I think if England could have understood that, I guess they finally did come to understand that with the creation of the Dominion system of their colonies later, but if England could have understood that early, there would have been no revolution. Because that was the strongest argument that united at least the intellectual elite in America on this. And then he goes on to mention the history of the present King of Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having a direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And he goes on and he lists a number of things here. I'll mention a few here. He dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmnesses invasions of the rights of the people. He's made judges dependent upon his will alone for the tenure of their office and the amount of payment of their salaries. He's erected in a multitude of new offices, sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people, eat out our substances, kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislature, affected to render the military independent of and superior to civil power, has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution, quartering large bodies of troops among us, protecting those troops from mock trial by punishment for any murders of which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, cutting off our trade with all ports, parts of the world. I think I forgot to mention that. Or I mentioned 34, the closing of all ports. Imposing taxes on us without our consent, depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, transporting us beyond the seas to be tried for pretended offenses. See if you can catch this one. For abolishing a free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing them an arbitrary government, enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule in these colonies. What was that? Yeah, the Quebec Act, very much so. Suspending our legislatures, declaring themselves invested with the power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Where's that from? Claiming they can legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Declaratory Act, right after the repeal of the Stamp Act. Yeah. Transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries, the Hessians. And then it wasn't beyond Jefferson to get a little Rush Limbaugh on us here and just completely fabricate things by saying this. He has excited domestic insurrections among us, has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. They're going to get the Indians to rape our women. or they already have. There's not evidence of that, that I know of. I've looked and tried to find that out. That the British, if that happened, it was not British orchestrated large numbers. But he's working on a propaganda document here. This is what this is about. But even the bigger thing I want to point out is, in every one of these cases, who got blamed? King George. Did he do all this? He probably nodded and winked and agreed with and laughed at. Sometimes I hear about people when they will say they didn't mind somebody got killed. I said, well, they weren't even guilty. They laughed. So if the king is not the one who's doing all this, who is? Parliament. If Parliament is doing this, why isn't Parliament blamed in this document?
It's easier to blame a person than the group.
It is true, yeah. And you can center more emotional anger at one specific person. Which I think is, in a sense, being unfairly done to Bush right now about Louisiana. That's also traditionally part of the job, of taking the heat.
Because they ignore the olive branch petition.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a good the olive branch petition combined with this, there is another purpose here. Kind of multiple purposes. One is
the
documentation of a king that doesn't take care of its subjects, And therefore, why would you feel an emotional attachment to a monarch that doesn't care? In some ways, it's like teaching high school. I sometimes run across situations where there are children wanting to leave home before they're old enough and legally allowed to. And the stories I hear make me say, good for you, go today. But I don't say that. I can't, But when I hear this, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what a horrible situation. And what a tear emotionally it must be to have to face the fact that even a parent, blood relative, is so bad that it's better to be without. And I think in that kind of circumstance, that's what these people wanted to communicate to Americans, that you've got a long-running tradition of emotional ties to a monarch. You've got to cut those ties. They knew they had to work on that. So propagandistically, putting the blame on the king had the purpose of cutting those emotional ties with the monarch. There'd be no independence if there was always this kind of, can we negotiate for a separate dominion that ignores Parliament but recognizes the monarch, which did happen with the other British possessions. Canada, still to this day, Australia, independent governments that still, in a sense, recognize Queen Elizabeth as their sovereign. Some emotional sense, which we don't. There's another reason, too, and that Jefferson reasoned this one out, is there was a debate over who had the authority to make certain taxes. That was one of the great complaints about, does Parliament have a right to make an internal tax? If you blame them for making the tax, you acknowledge they were authorized to do it. If you instead leave them out of the formula and put the blame on the king, that helps strengthen the argument that they're just a bunch of pretenders, which there's a comment in here. Their pretended legislation is the closest he gets to eluding the Parliament. So it carries multiple purposes in blaming the king for this. I think this is an interesting comment. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. This was something I didn't stress enough, but the argument that British troops stationed in North America should have been under the command of both the governor and the legislatures, arguing that legislatures should be appropriating. If they're not appropriating monies, then those troops shouldn't be there, which again is a direct challenge to parliamentary authority. But it also gives us a hint into the future of our own government. When a chief executive is finally created in the Constitution, the president, they make sure that it is a commander-in-chief that is civilian rather than military. I think that's the main things I have to say, and as I turn my sheet to the next page, it's not there. I need a 37. I will find it. Here it is. I've got it, I hope. Yes. So on 37, I see at the top of the page, there's my division of public opinion, one-third, 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 that in addition to all these purposes I've listed, there was also a desire to unite public opinion and a desire to draw French support for the war. Here's a little something that I guess belongs nowhere, so I shouldn't say it, but I just want to say it. And that is, before France got involved in this war, those who are for independence in America call themselves Whigs. And those who are for loyalty call themselves Tories. With the reason for identifying, and you'll see this, these different terms used in the literature, the reason for the different terms is, in Parliament, the two political factions, they weren't full-blown parties like we would have later, but the factions were Whigs and Tories. Whigs tended to traditionally argue that more power should be delegated to the Parliament and less to the King. Tories, on the other hand, going all the way back to the restoration of Charles II in 1660, had always advocated stronger prerogative for the monarch and weakened role for Parliament. So in the struggle that when it started, Whigs, quite a few of them, spoke sympathetically and supportive of the American resistance, not the full revolutionary resistance, from the perspective of that if they're dealt with, if they're negotiated with, or if they win some of their demands, it can only result in greater voice for English people altogether. Parliament will have more voice than the people will from a reduced king power. And Tories, who felt a lot of it was class, that there's certain given folk who are special and those who aren't, and you don't want to give away power to the what would be in essence that whole third estate working class. They wanted to see the revolution squashed so that the power of the monarch that was already slipping could be strengthened. So loyalists in America took on the political factions of Parliament. After France got involved in the war, it was no longer patriotic at all to be for the American Revolution because you're pro-French at that time. So Whigs united with Tories against the revolution in Parliament, and the titles began to change in America to loyalist and patriot. Patriot being Whigs, loyalist being Tories. Back to this appeal to France. This is something that Franklin had begun working on in 1776. Franklin sailed to France, taking the risk of being captured on the open seas, and tried to call in all the favors he had from the past of having been such a big shot in Paris, which he had been. And from 76 through 78, early 78, for about a year and a half, what Franklin really did was line up a lot of private underground support for the revolution. One of the best known being involved in this is a playwright named Pierre Beaumarchais here in this lineup, who is the dramatist who wrote The Marriage of Figaro and The Barber of Seville, for those. And Beaumarchais did so in violation of French laws. It was illegal to give support to the American Revolution prior to 1778, and he was arrested and jailed for doing so. Which is why I put in the parentheses this little reference to Oliver North and China in the 1930s. I don't know if this is going to mean much to anybody here. To me, it was just a stark parallel here. What did Oliver North get into trouble with and then get immunity for?
Arms.
He was involved in the arms for hostages deal, which, if I remember correctly, I was going to tell all this, that American hostages were taken in Lebanon in the early 80s, as well as English hostages, and Reagan had come to office in many ways because of Carter's inability to deal with this. In fact, if you remember correctly, the Iranian hostages were not released until 20 minutes into Reagan's inaugural address, so that Ayatollah Khomeini could get the last thumbing in the nose of Carter. So when hostages again were taken in the Middle East, in Lebanon, this became something out that the Reagan administration wanted to be able to have a more positive record on than Carter. And so, as the story has it, moderate elements within the Iranian government, it's almost an oxymoron, but moderate elements within the Iranian government approached American officials with the idea that if you will sell us weapons so we can fight Saddam Hussein and the ongoing war going on, you can take that money and funnel it wherever you want to. And of course, what the Americans wanted to do was take that money and give it to the Contras in Nicaragua who are fighting against the Sandinista regime. So it would kind of get and also they would get the hostages free. Or Iran would exercise muscle on the Hezbollah to get the hostages free. They would win their war against Hussein, and we would get support for the Contras down in Nicaragua. All of this was hush-hush under the table, and in fact, illegal when Congress passed something called the Boland Amendment, saying that there could be no money given to the Contras. Well, if I understand this correctly, North and Poindexter working for the National Security Agency, were deeply involved in all of this. And we, if I'm correct on this, we gave them the weapons. They never paid us. They ripped us off on the money, so we had nothing to give the Contras. So in that respect, you can't say they gave illegal money to the Contras because they didn't get the money. And then after they got the weapons, Ayatollah Khomeini came out and made fun of Reagan, saying, "We tricked the great Satan twice, Carter and Reagan." So when this came to Senate investigation in the summer of 1986, Oliver North, who had violated, or tried to at least violate, the laws about giving aid to the Contras against congressional authority, he made two references. Pierre Beaumarchais. He commented that Beaumarchais was arrested in France, but he was a hero because he saw the real future and where you should go, just as I did. And then he said, if that's not enough, how about Franklin Roosevelt? And the reference he made there was that the neutrality laws of the 1930s made it illegal to give weapons to any countries at war, so we wouldn't get dragged in. But FDR knowingly allowed illegal aid to be funneled to China long before Lend-Lease. So, all that comes to mind when I think about the French working and behind the scenes trying to help the American Revolution come about. And in fact, getting France involved was tricky because what was this revolution being fought for? To expel monarchy. Why would the French king want to give his support to an American revolution which starts a flood of worldwide revolutions like Paine was writing about? Because Paine was writing in his works, French king's next, this king's next, etc. Why would he want to give support to that? Well, he was approached by ministers who said, the advantage here is it's over there on that side of the world. It doesn't have to affect us in terms of endangering your reign. But the loss of America, one-third of the business and one-fifth of the population of the British Empire, will be a giant blow to our traditional enemy, England. That's the reason to support it. So he was being kind of smoothed over for quite some time by Franklin and other people that Franklin had connections to. Yes, that was worth going. And of course, as we know what happens, once France does get involved and support us and we win, revolutionary fervor spreads to France and they cut his head off, so it's a fear that follows. But we're a little bit ahead of that. That's down in item 40, so let's work on that. Well, so the Declaration is promulgated, announced, accepted. That doesn't necessarily mean that 1776 is filled with many great military victories. It's a hard year. The British, by the end of summer, take over New York, and from summer throughout fall of 76, Washington's colonial army is driven, either flees or loses battles continually throughout the fall across New Jersey into Pennsylvania. And the only victory of that ending winter time period of 76 here is the surprise attack on Christmas Day at Trenton, or the crossing of the Delaware. And a very interesting thing occurred here, that at the time, as Christmas approached in 76, a number of soldiers, reasonably, understandably, were taking off to go back home because nobody had harvested or cared for families or farms, etc. Enlistments were running out. They hadn't been paid. So there wasn't a lot, they were not well fed and clothed. There wasn't a lot of incentive other than just the mission. And that's what Washington continually worked on. And so it came to Washington that what was needed was some kind of great morale builder right around recruitment time to keep these people involved. And that's why he reasoned out that, from what he understood from the spies, is the Hessians and the British soldiers would be partying quite strong on Christmas Eve and sleeping in with hangovers on Christmas Day. And who would think someone in that kind of terrible weather on that night would cross a river where it's rained so much that all the powder's wet, you can't fire a gun and attack? So he did. And brought 700-800 soldiers across the river. Two died because on the way marching they sat down and froze to death. All the rest survived. None were killed in battle. They all attacked with bayonets and captured all the Hessians and all the British. And in fact, a British spy saw this taking place, raced to the head of the German Hessian command to give him the message that all these people are crossing the river, and he was so hung over, he says, "I won't be disturbed till the morning." So, could have been stopped, but turned out that way. A great PBS video was put together. It's called The Crossing. With Jeff Bridges playing with Washington. If you get a chance to see that, it's really worth watching. It's very moving. So that kept the Army intact. And again, much of it's so much due to Washington's character. Washington was such a timely person. When the war was over, 1782 to 1783, before the Constitution and the earliest days of independence, the Continental Congress had not paid many of the soldiers, especially officers, from back during the fighting years. They were grumbling and upset, had not disbanded their troops yet, and there were rumors spreading that they were thinking of using their troops in a military coup and overthrow in order to take over the government so they would get paid. Washington heard of this, heard of the Newburgh conspiracy, came to them, pull out glasses, put them on, put out a piece of paper, unfolded it, apologized for having to use his spectacles because he had grown weak in eyesight in his commitment to the cause for everybody out there listening, and read from his speech, in essence, shame on all y'all, is exactly what it was. He said, you know, we went through this together for the sake of independence, and then you a little of greed and ambition get in the way of the greatest experiment. These are not the people I raised. And then it worked. They said, okay, that's it, we can, no revolution. And it was Washington's character that brought them over these. He came to be known as the Great Cincinnatus, a Roman general that twice had led troops in battle and then retired to civilian life rather than become an emperor in Rome. And this parallel to Washington, and the Order of Cincinnatus, by the way, was the early veterans organization named for him. The city, current city of Cincinnati was once called Fort Washington for obvious reasons. Washington proved this same attitude when twice he became head of first the Continental Army, retired to civilian life, then became president of the United States, and after two terms retired to civilian life rather than hang on. So it's kind of interesting to wonder, both revolution as well as early government, if we had a different character, a different person than Washington, how the country would have turned out. Many said that he should become a first king, King George the First. He could be an enlightened despot. He could be one that institutes democratic reforms through a Congress because he could get things done, and he refused. 39. The winters of 1777 to 1778 at Valley Forge involved these particular military experts who helped train the American troops: Lafayette from France, von Steuben from Prussia, Pulaski and Kosciuszko and Dekalb from Poland. And these were all people who had come from countries that were under severe monarchical control, who hoped by contributing to the American Revolution that would lead to eventually democracy in their countries. I read this, that a number of Georgian soldiers who fought in Washington's army were so impressed with Pulaski that they told stories to their children, who later grew up and moved west across the Mississippi into Arkansas and established the county named Pulaski for him in Arkansas. Item 40. There's not many battles on my test. This is one that is. I have not many battles on my presentation. But the Saratoga battle, that occurred in October of 1777. This was a plan by General Burgoyne of the British to take forces from New York and Canada, meet in upstate New York, defeat the colonists, separate New York and New England from the middle colonies, and in that probably be able to win the war. But instead of it turning out for a British victory, because of the leadership of Benedict Arnold a second time, again someone who we only know of in terms of having betrayed the secrets of West Point, Saratoga turned out to be a great turning point victory. And it was important because it wasn't just guerrilla hit and run insurgency type fighting, it was full flank frontal warfare between forces in the field. And so when this kind of victory could be demonstrated by the American forces, this gets the attention of the French. So now the lobbying efforts of people like Franklin and others bear fruit. Silas Dean is also a diplomat who was with Benjamin Franklin. Dean will later be arrested for treason, and I think unfairly and false to say. But anyway, Franklin's efforts in France following the Saratoga victory convinced the French to agree to a treaty, to an alliance, February 1778. The Franco-American Treaty of Amity, Commerce, and Alliance. It included these provisions. First, both parties, the French and the Americans, pledged to continue fighting in this conflict until both are ready to quit. No one's going to quit early. They're going to stay committed till all military objectives for both sides have been achieved. This the Americans desperately needed because they did not want to see the French gain their hits on the British and then run and leave them defeated. But it also meant something which would come back to haunt the United States for the coming century, and that is being committed to an alliance to fight for the needs of a European that has nothing to do to help us. This was very bothersome. That if France gets itself in a war with all its neighbors endlessly, if we have any honor, are we going to continue to fight in that conflict? And when this was debated in the Continental Congress, the answer was yes, that's exactly what it means, and that's what we will do. That the foreign policy of Europe had always been one of your allied as long as it's to your advantage, and then as long as your advantage, you cut and run and leave an ally hanging. And that's Europeans. That's the way they think. This is kind of an American, ethnocentric, Aryan attitude, but the Europeans can't be trusted, Americans can. This country's based on honor, and this country's based on honesty and foreign policy. If we make a commitment, we're going to stick to it. So that first part was a tricky agreement, but seemed as necessary. Second part of the agreement. Both countries would trade with each other tariff-free, no trade barriers. Which may not seem like as important as the first part, but the U.S. had a lot more to offer in the form of trade than they did military assistance. Odds are good that giving American trade to France would be the greater benefit than any military help on the road. And this became something that was the forefront of American foreign policy. If you received American trade without trade barriers, without tariffs, that made you kind of like a special friend. And it was a sizable amount of trade. And the restriction of that trade could be used the same way. So, no trade barriers between France and America, and no one leaves the conflict till both are ready. Well, item 41, the British failure in the North causes them to rethink their whole approach. And what is then dreamed up is the belief, mistaken belief, that Southerners are far more loyalist than our middle and northern state people. They're plantation owners, they're wealthy elites. As slave owners, they have the class-minded attitude that the British have. They're not like these radical Bostonians, others. So when we land in the southern colonies and start up the coast, it'll probably be like everybody just rises up and join us. Like what was thought would happen in the Bay of Pigs and didn't, and elsewhere. So that was the British thinking, is to land and recruit American loyalist support that supposedly in large percentages in the South. Wasn't there, the support wasn't there, any more so than the North. So their next approach was to go to slave plantations and promise slaves that if you fight for the British, you'll be liberated. Seeing this approach, the Americans took the same tact and promised their slaves. Both lied a lot about that, but if it means anything, the Americans kept their word better than the British. Maybe because the British lost, but a lot of those slaves that had enlisted and were with the British when Cornwallis evacuated were dumped in the Caribbean slave plantations rather than freed. So when the British saw their plan was failing, and as they marched through the Carolinas from south to north into Virginia, they made plans to retreat and evacuate out of the Chesapeake Bay. which never succeeded because they were bottled up by the combined French Navy as well as French Army forces with Washington's Army, and defeated in October of 1781, I should say 81, number 42, at the Battle of Yorktown, the final battle of the war. Did I talk about Cornwallis already? I think I did, didn't I? You know, saying that, that he was the general that lost his battle, but in British history he's remembered as the longest, most successful, kindest Governor General of India, colonial governor. We just remember Cornwallis as the one, because he lost, we won the revolution. Days young, enthusiasm's high. Let's plow forward for just a little more here. For one good reason, this is great stuff. I love it here. Okay, conflict's over. Now it's time for the peace treaty. These three names in item 43 are sent to Paris for that purpose. John Adams, one who was worried about it. Some people don't understand what the revolution was all about. John Jay, who would later be the first Chief Justice of the United States, a job he thought was so boring he quit to become an ambassador to Britain instead. And of course, Ben Franklin. They arrive in late 1781 and cool their heels till nearly 1783. Because the French aren't ready to quit fighting. The Americans achieved their objective, but the French aren't ready to stop. And actually the French didn't have an objective they wanted. It was just this. The French had dragged the Spanish into the conflict on the promise that the Spanish will get Gibraltar back. This is why I mentioned back in the Utrecht Treaty. And the British were unwilling to release it. So most of the problems of 1782, waiting for a treaty to come about, was Spanish still demanding Gibraltar, the British refusing to grant it, the French kind of being the middleman in between all this, and all the time telling the Americans, just wait, just wait. Well, in 1782, Frederick North stopped being the Prime Minister of Britain. Been there since 70, now 82. And all kinds of mystery starts to circulate. The British could have, had they wanted to be, you know, obstinate enough about this, say the war's not over, we're going to come back and win this thing. And a change in administration to a more hawkish Prime Minister might lead to that. So what the American delegates thought, well, maybe that's why Europeans cut and run on allies, is because critical moments shouldn't be lost, and we better start negotiating with the British while they're still willing to negotiate. So they went through the process of waiting for communications to get back to the Continental Congress to get permission to violate their orders, and the Continental Congress came back with, "You cannot. This is an honor issue. You will wait and wait for the French to be with you on this." And so as 82 starts to turn into 83, this is where, if I can find on the map, they discover something taking place. And here's what here's what's going on. I've got a map. This will help us here. At the start of the conference, it seemed a given that Britain was going to accept and recognize the new independent United States extending as far west as the Mississippi. They discover that what they're trying to do now to pacify the Spanish, since the Spanish weren't going to get back Gibraltar, to give back not only Florida, but the lands west of Georgia all the way up to the Ohio River. And since they were going to give this to the Spanish, the British were just thinking of keeping this as part of Quebec. So what the delegates realize is if they don't move quick, the United States will just be up to the Appalachians rather than the Mississippi. So in complete defiance of congressional order, they cut a separate treaty with the British, which when sent back to the Continental Congress is ratified with that complaint. And those provisions are in 45. So the Spanish get Florida, but they don't get Gibraltar. and the French response to the Spanish is, the Americans, you can't trust them. Here's the treaty. We'll list all 7 parts and then be done. Most important one, the American independence. Of course, you know what this is going to be. All the following are true except multiple choice questions. So you have to memorize them all. So, American independence. Second, the new boundaries of this nation, which would be the Mississippi River is the western boundary. The Great Lakes will be the northern boundary with some clarification up from New York up to Maine. And Florida would be the southern boundary. But as this map correctly shows, which Florida? At the 31st parallel or the 32nd parallel? The second. And that would leave that disputed area there right in here. Between the 31st and 32nd parallel would come to be known as the Yazoo Strip and be settled in a future treaty. Third provision, the Mississippi River, the watershed of all the central part of the North American continent, would be shared by both the British and the Americans, and I guess obviously the Spanish, because the Spanish are going to receive the land, but they already have the lands west of America. This is all still Spanish, and so they obviously have used, but the British, wanting to use rivers that flow out of this area where they have fur trapping as well as Canada, will be allowed to use the Mississippi River as will Americans for navigation. Canadian waters will still be available for American fishing, since as part of the empire before they had used to that, this is a commercial right that will be retained. There's a lot of commercial aspects to this treaty. Next provision. Colonial merchants who owed debts to British merchants or banks would still owe those debts. Independence doesn't wipe out financial obligations. That's something the Russians in the Russian Revolution did, was to announce and say that Tsarist bourgeois debts will not be saddled on the backs of the proletariat Russian people. We are not paying back these debts to French banks. Which then later, when they needed desperately in the 1930s to borrow money from somewhere, no one would lend them money because you couldn't trust communists to get back debts. Provision 6, loyalists, or the Tories in America, were to have their lands restored, or as it was, the provision was, Congress was to earnestly recommend that states restore the land. What had happened was, a lot of these loyalists, when they saw which way the wind was blowing, to use the Bob Dylan phrase, took off and headed off to Canada, and the lands were quickly taken by the local states and awarded to patriots for their service, some of it in lieu of pay. So how are states going to tell a patriot we have to give back the land to the enemy that ran away to Canada? That's unlikely. And the last one, the 7th provision, is the British, which occupied military forts in this Great Lakes area, agreed to evacuate the forts and move to Canada. Now that's a good treat, good provisions. Would have been better if most of them had been honored. The last 3 were not. Colonials did not repay their debts to British merchants. Land confiscated from the loyalists was never given back to them. Colonial merchants argued we can't make enough money to pay back these debts because of British tariffs. The British therefore argued since you didn't honor those 2 provisions of the treaty, we're not getting out of the forts. And they remained in the forts into the 1790s. Which was a good excuse. The real reason is we're making a lot of money on the fur trade, and the British rightly feared that the day would come and Americans would want to invade Canada, and it's nice to have Indian allies working for you to stop that. So those are the 7 provisions, and when we return, we should have an exciting quiz, and after the quiz, pick up on 1783-1789, number 1. And it will be an exciting quiz. That's not just propaganda.